enemies is to demonstrate Islam as inefficient to adapt itself to the problems of the modern world and to tackle problems of contemporary man. He used to warn the masses and scholars that two groups of people are trying to depict Islam as unable to solve social and political problems. The first group ignorantly considers Islam far from the social and political arenas of human life, and the second group wickedly denies the political identity of this religion. The Imam wrote in his testament, "One of the important plots which can be seen, especially during the contemporary decades and particularly after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, is the widespread propaganda with different dimensions to disappoint the nation, especially the selfless Iranian nation, from Islam. Sometimes they say ineptly and expressly that the laws of Islam that have been passed 1,400 years ago cannot administer countries in the modern era, or that Islam is a reactionary religion and opposed to any innovation and civilization, and that in the modern era you cannot keep countries away from global civilization and its manifestations. Such foolish and occasionally sly and devilish propagandas are forged in the form of advocacy of Islam by raising issues like saying that Islam and other divine religions are engaged in spirituality, worshipping and praying, and government and politics are against their spiritual aim and purpose. And sadly, the second type of propaganda, separation of religion from politics, has affected some religious scholars or ulama and religious people who are unaware of Islam to the extent that they even consider interference in government and politics as sin and transgression. This is a great catastrophe that Islam has been suffering from." Founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, made it clear that individual and social laws of Islam do not become outdated with the passage of time. Imam Khomeini reiterated that this claim is like saying that the laws of mathematics change with time. He wrote in his testament, "As for the first group, it should be said that they are either unaware of government, law and politics, or they partially feign being unaware, because execution of laws on the basis of justice and prevention of injustice and oppressive rule and spread of individual and social justice and prohibition of corruption, indecency and various kinds of waywardness and freedom based on the criterion of intellect, justice and independence and prevention of colonialism, exploitation and worship of others instead of God and implementation of divine fixed rules, retaliation and specific rules on the basis of justice and fairness, and hundreds of the like are not the things to become outdated with the passage of time. In the history of mankind and social life, this is quite clear. This dispute is like saying that the laws of physics, the laws of science, and the laws of mathematics change with the passage of time, and that other rules should replace them. Claiming that Islam is opposed to innovation is no more than a foolish allegation, because if the manifestation of civilization mean inventions and advanced industries, Islam and no other monotheistic religion have been or will ever be opposed to it. Rather, science and industry are emphasized in Islam and the noble Quran." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also said in his testament, "As for the second group who design sly schemes and consider Islam separate from rule of politics, these ignorant people should be told that the Holy Quran and the practice of the Messenger of God, blessings of God upon him and his messenger, have so many laws on rule and politics that they exceed other areas. It is rather due to negligence of many ritual political laws of Islam that have caused these catastrophes. The Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, formed a ruling like other ruling systems in the world, but with the motive of spreading social justice. But the first caliphs of Islam had vast rules, and the rule of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was founded more vastly with the same motive or among the axioms of history. And after that, gradually the ruling system was in the name of Islam. And now too, there are many who claim to follow Islam and the Holy Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in Islamic ruling system. Imam Khomeini also wrote in his testament, "I hope all writers, socialists and historians will take Muslims out of this mistake. What has been said, that the messengers were engaged in spirituality and government and the affairs of world, are rejected, and that the divine messengers and saints would refrain from them, and thus we should also follow them, is an unfortunate mistake, whose consequences are to corrupt the Islamic nations and opening the way for the bloodthirsty colonialism. Because what is rejected are the satanic, dictatorial and oppressive rules, which have been prevented due to seeking dominance and pervert worldly motives that they had. But the rightful rule for the benefit of the downtrodden and prevention of oppression and injustice and for establishment of social justice is the same principle, for instance, of Prophet Solomon, the son of David, peace be upon him, and Grand Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his great legatees would try for it. This is among the greatest obligations, and the maintenance of it is among the loftiest worships, as the healthy politics that existed in these rules is among the necessary affairs."
Years ago, the first democratically elected government in the Middle East and West Asia was overthrown in an Anglo-American coup plot. The victim was Mohammad Mossadegh, the champion of the nationalization of the oil industry in Iran. Operation Ajax, as the plot was codenamed by the Americans, and Operation Boot, as it is referred to by the British, reshaped the history of Iran, the Middle East, and even the world. It restored Mohammad Reza Shah to the peacock throne, a lautry with an iron fist that eventually sparked the Islamic Revolution of 1979 in Iran. On March 15, 1951, legislation to nationalize the Iranian industry was passed by the Majlis. Spearheaded by Dr. Mossadegh, the courageous move won him huge popularity among the masses, but at the same time earned him British enmity. Britain, which did not want to lose its privileges regarding the Iranian oil fields, built up diplomatic pressure, asked the UN to intervene, and in the end, tried to threaten the Iranian government by sending the British Navy to the Persian Gulf against Mossadegh, who assumed power in the Prime Minister's office a month later. Despite all this, Mossadegh emerged triumphant from the 1952 parliamentary elections and used the victory to intensify anti-Shah and anti-British rhetoric. Iranian oil was an existential priority for the United Kingdom. The Iranian refinery of the Anglo-Iran Oil Company, AIOC, which would later become British Petroleum, BP, was the world's largest refinery. Depending largely on Iranian resources, the company was the world's second largest crude oil exporter, with the third largest reserves under its control. Perhaps an even more important fact, the company alone met the British Navy's 85% fuel needs. Unable to take the Iranian Prime Minister under control, Britain sought America's blessing to act against Mossadegh's government. But President Harry Truman explicitly rejected such British proposals. The elections in the United States, however, came to Britain's aid. Shortly after Dwight Eisenhower's election in November 1952, Britain sent agents to Washington and persuaded the new president's team to orchestrate the coup. For this purpose, Kermit Roosevelt, the Middle East director of the CIA, arrived in Tehran in June 1953 and began bribing a significant number of politicians and journalists to destroy Mossadegh's popularity and create chaos in Iran as a precursor of the coup. The demonization of Mossadegh began through fabrications and slanders, a systematic effort to influence public opinion against the politician who stood outside the orbit of the West.
The US and Britain had the same level of involvement in carrying out the coup. As much as $5 million were spent buying support from senior officials, military officers, newspaper editors, and thugs to carry out the Western-backed plot to overthrow the democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh.
At the same time, Britain launched an economic war against Iran along with an international propaganda campaign. London also froze Iran's assets in Britain, forbade exports of oil drilling equipment to Iran. The British also started threatening potential customers interested in Iranian oil. The US, on the other hand, cancelled a previously promised $25 million loan to Iran. The circle around Mossadegh began to narrow as the markets and ordinary traders began to feel the pinch of the economic crisis. It was then that Churchill and Eisenhower officially ratified the coup plan in early July. They made the Shah issue an order for the dismissal of Mossadegh from his post, even though it was against the constitution. After a failed coup attempt on August 15th, which led to the escape of Mohammad Reza Shah abroad, the second attempt on August 19th caught the Iranian Prime Minister off guard. The crowd on the CIA's payroll seized the streets, while pro-Shah forces besieged Mossadegh's residence and captured him after 9 hours of fighting. Mossadegh was tried in a military court, served 3 years in prison, and died under house arrest in 1967.
As a result of this coup, Mohammad Mossadegh was arrested, tried, and convicted of treason by the Shah's military court. This is the tip of the iceberg that shows and reveals the expansionist policies of the hegemonic powers in the world.
The monarchy, restored under the pro-Western Shah and Anglo-Iranian oil, renamed British Petroleum, tried to get its fields back, though it could return to the conditions prior to the nationalization of oil. The effects of the coup were far more profound than those planned by the coup plotters. Kinzer, in his book All the Shah's Men, writes, "A significant factor behind the public anger toward the US during the Islamic Revolution was the role played by Washington in the 1953 coup." The coup, an imperialistic response to the nationalization of oil, is still regarded as the root cause of distrust between Iran and the US. After almost 7 decades after the coup, the Iranian nation is still cynical about the Americans' intentions at the highest levels. In the words of former CIA operator Robert Baer, Iranians truly believe that if it weren't for the CIA, the Shah would never have been brought to power, and they believe that the CIA continues to operate as an evil force in their country. American and British involvement in Mossadegh's ouster was long public knowledge, but neither the Americans nor the British formally acknowledged their roles until 64 years later. On August 19, 2013, the CIA publicly admitted for the first time its involvement in the 1953 coup. Denied by Britain until 2020, the coup exposes the machinations of the Western powers to dispose popular civilian politicians while backing repressive rulers like the Shah of Iran whenever their interests require it. Last year, a discovered transcript of an interview with a British intelligence officer indicated that Britain was the driving force behind the overthrow of Mossadegh. In his account, Norman Derbyshire said Britain had convinced the US to take part in the coup. A part of the transcript reads, "The plan would have involved seizure of key points in the city by what units we thought were loyal to the Shah, seizure of the radio station, etc., the classical plan." The 1953 coup dashed all the hopes of a nation that yearned for a democratic government during the tyranny of Mohammad Reza Shah and poisoned the relationship between Iran and the US in the following decades. Iran's deep distrust of the US is firmly founded on what the Americans did on August 19, 1953.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When an Israeli regime troop shoots a Palestinian child in the head, or a Palestinian teenager, or demonstrator, or plumber through the heart, Israeli society is mute and apathetic, says Gideon Levy, writer, in an article titled, "In Occupied Territories, Cold-Blooded Killing of Palestinians is Met with Silence." Stay tuned for more. Scores of unarmed Palestinians, including children, have been murdered since the end of the Zionist regime's May assault. Yet this is now so normal. The Israeli regime, media, and army barely mention it. Superficially, things are relatively quiet these days in the Israeli-occupied territories. There are no Israeli casualties, almost no attacks in the West Bank, and certainly not inside the occupied territories. Gaza has been quiet since the end of the Israeli regime's latest offense there, Operation Guardian of the Walls. In the West Bank, the despair-inducing routine of daily life grinds on during this so-called period of quiet, which is precisely the irony crying out for the notice in this terrifying statistic. Since May, more than 40 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. In a single week at the end of July, the Israeli regime military killed 4 Palestinians, one of them a child of 12. 2 of the 40 were from one village, Beita, which lately has lost 6 of its residents. 5 were unarmed protesters, and 1 was a plumber reportedly summoned to fix a faucet somewhere. None of the four killed in late July posed any threat to the lives of any Israeli troop or settler. Using live ammunition against any of these people were prohibited, never mind aiming to kill, as did the Israeli regime soldiers who shot them. Four human beings, or, if you prefer, 40 human beings with families whose world was shattered, people with plans and dreams and loves, all suddenly ended by some young Israeli regime troop so casually and so brutally. In case all that is not enough, note this. The Israeli regime media hardly covered these killings. Neither of the Israeli regime's two leading newspapers mentioned the killing of the 12-year-old boy in Beit Omar between Beit Lahm and Al-Khalil, nor did either of the two most important commercial television stations bother to report it. Put another way, the killing of a boy of 12, Muhammad Al-Alami, who had been shopping with his father and sister when Israeli regime troops leveled a stream of bullets into the family's car, killing the boy, who, like his father, had done nothing wrong. This was evidently deemed by some Israeli regime media a story of no importance and no interest. There is no other way to explain this widespread inattention to an act of murder. Consider also that all those murders since May were barely reported, never mind investigated, and you get a picture of the Israeli regime's repression and denial of the occupation via the media's version of Iron Dome, courtesy of the free press in all its wretchedness. Protected by a silenced media, Israelis were spared this ugly picture of their army and its brutal modus operandi. Protected by that silence, denial, and repression, even Israeli regime politicians and generals were not made to explain or even address the fact that rarely a week goes by in the occupied territories without Palestinian casualties, even during this relatively quiet period. If the troops were to shoot the stray animals as casually as they shoot Palestinians, there would be public howls of outrage, and the troops would be tried and severely punished. Thus, until a few days ago, no army commander had issued any criticism of the behavior of these troops, let alone any mention of bringing charges or opening a serious investigation. Only after a series of articles and editorials in Haaretz did Commander-in-Chief Lieutenant General Aviv Kochavi communicate a request to lower the temperature. Not an order, a request, no charges, and no investigation. Just a vague declaration of good intentions for the future. Behind all this is contempt for Palestinian lives. Nothing is valued less in the occupied territories called Israel than the life of a Palestinian. Draw a straight line from the construction workers falling like flies to their death at building sites in occupied territories with nobody to care, to the unarmed protesters in the occupied territories fatally shot by Israeli regime troops, why nobody bats an eye. One common factor unites them all: the conviction in occupied territories that Palestinian lives are cheap. If the troops were to shoot stray animals as casually as they shoot Palestinians, there would be public howls of outrage, and the troops would be tried and severely punished. But they are only killing Palestinians, so what's the problem? When an Israeli troop shoots a Palestinian child in the head, or a Palestinian teenager, or demonstrator, or plumber through the heart, Israeli regime society is mute and apathetic. It makes do with the flimsy explanations and sometimes outrage lies provided by the Israeli regime army spokesperson, omitting any expression of moral qualms about the need to kill. So many of these fatalities have been investigated and documented and written about in the newspaper have evoked no particular interest. Shadi Omar Lutfi Salim, 41, a prosperous plumber who lived in Beita in the central West Bank, left home on the evening of July 24th, heading for the main road where the mains valve to the village water supply was located, after someone evidently discovered a problem there. He parked his Jeep alongside the road and walked back toward the valve, a red monkey wrench in his hand. It was 10:30 p.m. As he neared the valve, Israeli regime troops in the vicinity suddenly opened fire and fatally shot him. They later claimed that he had run toward them holding a metal bar. The only metal bar was a red monkey wrench left behind on the ground alongside his packet of cigarettes and a bloodstain, already dry when people got there a few days after his death. One week later, in the same village, troops killed Ahmad Ali Duwekat, 37, a construction laborer, father of four young daughters and a two-month-old baby. This was during the village weekly Friday protest. Beita residents had been demonstrating weekly for the last 2 months or so against the establishment of a rogue outpost on village land. The settlement, Givat Evitar, was erected unofficially and then emptied of its residents by the Zionist regime, but 40 structures rapidly built there were not demolished. The land has been returned to its owners, who are not allowed to come near it. Since Givat Evitar was launched over 10 weeks ago, 5 Palestinian protesters have already been killed there by the Zionist regime troops. None of the 5 was close enough to endanger the troops in any way, even as demonstrators were throwing stones and burning tires to protest against the takeover of their land. The residents are determined to continue resisting until their lands will return to them. And meanwhile, the blood flows week after week. The Wakeout was drinking a glass of water when an Israeli regime sniper chose him, apparently at random, and shot him through the heart from a distance of several hundred meters. The bullet exploded inside his body, damaging his internal organs, and Duwekat died on the spot, blood pouring from his mouth. His baby boy, Ali, was made an orphan soon after his birth. Weeks earlier, the Zionist regime troops shot teenager Muhammad Munir al-Tamimi from another protesting village, Nabi Saleh, and killed him. Tamimi was 17 and became his small village fifth fatality in the last few years. Everyone in the community belongs to the Tamimi family, and for years now, they have been resisting the theft of their lands by the surrounding settlements. These deaths were all executions. There is no other way to describe them. Shooting unarmed protesters, teenagers, children, a plumber, a construction laborer, people demonstrating publicly in the quest to regain their property and their freedom is a crime. Even the grumbling head here and there and the systematic killing has to do with whether it might lead to a deterioration in the situation overall. On the question of the legality and especially the morality of the matter of innocence, nobody says a word.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible Imam. Infallible Imam's extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads. Imam Hussein revolted to set a role model and he refused to surrender. He asked people to help him, and when a group of people from Kufa expressed their willingness to accompany him on this path, Imam Hussein accepted their offer and moved towards Kufa, and he did not give up in the middle of the way. Imam Hussein stood up against the deviated current of his time, which was extremely dangerous. And this became a lesson, and Imam Hussein himself makes the same point. That is to say, he backed up his action with the order of Islam. He said that his duty was what he was doing. He said that he had to express his opposition, no matter what the consequences were. He said, it is good if my destiny is a victory and if my destiny is martyrdom. So much the better. This was how Imam Hussein acted. This was a perfect instance of self-sacrifice and it safeguarded Islam.
Ana mazlum Hussein
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
This move preserved Islam. This move institutionalized values in society. If Imam Hussein had not accepted this danger, if he had not made a move, if he had not taken action, if his blood had not been shed, if those great tragedies had not happened to the shrine of the Holy Prophet, to Imam Ali's daughter, and to the Holy Prophet's descendants, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people and history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice. Of course, this is easier said than done. What Imam Hussein did was an extraordinary feat. That is to say, the dimensions of his action are far more than what we estimate.
Allah
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Britain plans to establish offshore asylum centers for Afghan refugees in countries such as Pakistan and Turkey, as ministers admit that the United Kingdom will not be able to rescue those eligible for resettlement before troops leave Kabul, the Afghan capital. The Defence Secretary Ben Wallace said in a newspaper article on Sunday, 22nd of August, that the United Kingdom planned to establish a series of processing hubs across the region outside of Afghanistan for Afghans it had an obligation to. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalist Dan Sabag. The piece is titled UK Plans Offshore Asylum Centres in Other Countries for Afghans. Britain plans to establish offshore asylum centres for Afghan refugees in countries such as Pakistan and Turkey, as ministers admit that the United Kingdom will not be able to rescue those eligible for resettlement before troops leave Kabul. Britain's Defence Secretary Ben Wallace said in a newspaper article on Sunday, 22nd of August, that the United Kingdom planned to establish a series of processing hubs across the region outside of Afghanistan. For Afghans, it had, quote, an obligation to, unquote. At least 1,429 Afghans have been evacuated from Kabul since last Friday as part of the Arab relocation scheme designed to help interpreters and others who have helped the British troops during their 20 years of occupation in Afghanistan. But it is estimated that a similar number or more remain in the country. The emergency airlift was continuing on Sunday with RAF flights operating despite a crash at the airport gates as desperate Afghans tried to flee Afghanistan. NATO believes 20 people have died around the airport in the last week, but Britain's Armed Forces Minister, James Hippie, said the flow outside the airport had improved because the Taliban were marshalling people into separate queues for the US evacuation and the UK evacuation. A total of 1,721 people, Britons, Afghans and people from allied countries, had been evacuated from Kabul on 8 flights in the past 24 hours. James Hippie said, with the RAF receiving help from its Australian counterpart in getting people to safety. But British officials already acknowledge it is virtually impossible to evacuate people coming from outside of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital, although Afghans, with a claim, have told charity workers they would risk crossing the country if they knew they had a flight. The new proposal was born out of the emergency. Britain's Defence Secretary Ben Wallace said in an article in the Mail on Sunday. The Arab scheme is not time-limited. We shall stand by our obligations and are investigating now how to process people from third countries and refugee camps, he wrote. However, there were signs that the asylum plan had not been very far developed on Sunday night, 22nd of August, when Turkey said it had not been approached and would reject any approach that was made. A scheme to establish an offshore immigration centre was included as part of the Home Office's Nationality and Borders Bill, published in the early summer before the Western-backed government in Afghanistan collapsed. It was controversial because the intention was to allow the United Kingdom to send people to a third country to allow their claims to be processed over there. Officials had begun talks with Denmark about creating a processing center in Africa, but how it will link together to the emergency centers is unclear. Britain has also agreed to take 20,000 Afghan refugees in a separate scheme announced on Tuesday, 5,000 of which will be in the first year. Priority will be given to groups who are most at risk of human rights abuses, such as women, girls, and those from religious minorities. Ministers are also debating how to respond to the Taliban, with the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, understood to be exploring with security officials whether they should be proscribed as a terrorist organization. However, Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other government departments have been holding out the possibility of recognising the Taliban government in Kabul, arguing that the Taliban should be judged by their actions and not words.
World with reporters.
In an interview with the Al Khanadiq website, the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation for peace, Mohammed Abdus Salam, said the UK presence on Yemen soil is not new, and Yemenis reject any form of foreign presence on their land, and it is their right to fight those who come to invade the country militarily.
Since the beginning of the war, Yemeni people have rejected the foreign presence in any form and cannot accept that. We have made great sacrifices for our freedom and independence and to clean our land from foreign forces. Today, the world is following what is happening in Al-Mara Governorate. People of Yemen cannot accept the Saudi British occupation of Al-Mara, and we have come to the conviction that armed struggle is necessary to expel foreign forces, whether in Al-Mara or elsewhere.
Regarding the developments in Marib, Abdus Salam said the liberated areas from forces backed by the Saudi-led military coalition and the Western Governorate are equal to the size of two Persian Gulf states. The chief negotiator added that battles are still going on in Marib and other fronts. He said the recent initiative offered by Yemen's Ansarullah movement is the key to end the war that the coalition started against Yemen in 2015, but Saudis have no real intentions to move politically. However, he noted that the initiative is still in force.
The other party must accept the initiative presented by Ansarullah because it establishes a comprehensive political solution. The other party will regret it if they didn't respond to this initiative because it aims to stop the war completely and end the suffering of Yemenis. Unfortunately, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates are the ones who have took the power to decide, and we are ready to talk with the Yemeni parties if they have enough courage to take action by themselves.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has intensified its air raids on Marib in what experts describe as a desperate attempt to back the Saudi-backed forces on the ground, as the Yemeni army keeps marking new advances toward the city of Marib.
Experts believe that Ansarullah has the upper hand as the Yemeni army keeps advancing toward the city of Marib. They say Ansarullah's initiative is a great opportunity for Riyadh to get rid of the quagmire it's stuck with its war on Yemen. Yeah, Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana.
Seoul Metropolitan Government's Yongsan City Memorial Exhibition Hall is holding an exhibit, July 16th, Yongsan. It shows footage for the first time in South Korea of the July 16th, 1950 U.S. bombing of Yongsan, Central Seoul's district, which killed hundreds of civilians.
U.S. B-29 bombers sent to destroy military targets like Yongsan Station switchyard also hit civilian buildings. 3 weeks before, on June 25th, the Korean War had broken out and North Korean forces had crossed the 38th parallel, capturing Seoul just 3 days later.
The footage obtained from the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration shows bombs being dropped and bodies strewn on the ground. Videos and photos edited from it are organized under four themes to highlight wartime suffering and healing after the 1953 armistice.
The bombing killed at least 1,587 of Yongsan's 193,000 residents, and 47 B-29 bombers dropped some 1,500 bombs, as this bomber was highly inaccurate and had to drop many bombs.
The event draws many curious visitors from Seoul and Greater Seoul's smaller cities and towns.
I'm glad the footage was released. Forgetting this incident would be a tragedy. We should not ignore or hide an unexpectedly large number of civilian deaths an aerial bombing unintentionally caused.
West of Seoul in Incheon, General Douglas MacArthur's statue overlooks the port where he led the famed September 1950 landing that led to the South recovering Seoul.
Some people criticize him because he did not take, at least this is what they say, enough care to minimize civilian casualties during the bombing of Yongsan Station in 1950.
In his latest speech on the anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japan's colonial rule at World War II's end, the same day Korea was divided, the South's president urged inter-Korean peace, the exhibit's underlying message.
East and West Germany achieved unification after 45 years. Division is the biggest obstacle to our growth and prosperity, a tenacious barrier to permanent peace. Like Germany, we can remove it.
The exhibit, which opened recently on the anniversary of the bombing and will run at least until this year's end, serves as a powerful reminder war must never happen on the Korean Peninsula again. Jennifer Chang, Seoul.
As part of a new plot to seize further Palestinian lands, the Jewish National Fund, a Zionist organization, has initially agreed to allocate $100 million to register the Palestinian lands in East Al-Quds and the West Bank in name of settlers. The new plan could lead to the eviction of further Palestinians from their homes in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. According to Israeli Peace Now Group, the establishment is encouraging settlers to confiscate more Palestinian lands. The piece now noted that the right-wing regime of Israel is seeking to seize more Palestinian lands through the Jewish National Fund.
This regime will do anything in its power to first expand settlements and second to annex more Palestinian areas. And now, with the help of this gang establishment known as the Jewish National Fund, Bennett's regime is working to achieve his goal, that is to back illegal settlement construction.
The fund covers about 17,000 properties, most of them inhabited by Palestinians. Observers say this is the same scenario carried out earlier in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. Palestinian families are fighting legal battles to prove their ownership of the properties amid Israeli efforts to evacuate them forcefully from their homes.
The policy has been adopted many times in the past. Today, the Zionist organization is seeking to forge documents and displace more Palestinians both in West Bank and Al-Quds. They are after imposing their full control over the whole city.
The Jewish National Fund is a Zionist organization founded in 1901 to buy and develop land in Ottoman and Mandatory Palestine for Jewish settlers. Earlier this year, Israeli media reported that Israeli authorities recruited the Jewish National Fund to secretly buy Palestinian land for settlers. Palestinians warned that the move by the Jewish National Fund is another proof for Israel's attempts to illegally seize more land in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds by forced expulsion of real owners. They say, however, that they will never back down and they will continue resisting these Israeli plans. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The second day of the conference vote sessions in Iran's parliament started with reviewing the credentials of Ebrahim Raisi's pick for ICT Minister Issa Zarepour. As is the rule, two pros and two cons speak for or against the nominee, who will then defend his credentials for 30 minutes.
I am proud to announce that during my term in the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, I launched hundreds of science-based firms. Thanks to these efforts in 2011, we exported $20 million worth of software to other countries.
Mr. Zarepour does not have the expertise to run the ICT ministry. Furthermore, he does not have a fixed approach toward Parliament's bill on the protection of cyberspace. He has repeatedly flip-flopped on the issue. Mr. Zarepour, I ask you to clarify your stance. Do you agree or disagree with the cyberspace protection bill?
By the cyberspace protection bill, the legislator refers to a controversial bill recently introduced in Parliament that seeks to fill the legal voids in the Internet. Some believe if passed into law, the new bill would restrict the activities of cyber users, and others say it would ensure the intellectual property of online businesses in Iran.
The bill is yet to be passed into law and is pending now. I think if it becomes law, it will organize cyberspace in our country. It will protect the rights of online users. It will prevent cybercrimes. Every country has such a law. It's for the good of our people.
I think the draft bill needs to be revised. I do agree that there are serious legal voids with regards to cyberspace in our country, but could the new bill be implemented in a way that it would not make people worry about their online activities?
The credentials of the proposed ministers of intelligence, economy, and health were also put to debate on Sunday. Parliament had scheduled to review at least five nominees each day to wrap up the process by Tuesday. But after 2 days, lawmakers have managed to examine only five of the 19 ministerial picks. While lawmakers have vowed to wrap up the vote of confidence session swiftly, they're already behind schedule. They argue that this is because they're trying to be meticulous in studying the qualifications of the nominees. And this, they say, will lead to a new cabinet that has the least friction with people's representatives. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. The Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, their war, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban war comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by their members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported. Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020. Observers say